This is Dr. Mark Jennings in his teaching on New Testament text criticism. This is session number 2, How We Do Textual Criticism, Methodology.
Hi, and welcome back. My name is Mark Jennings, and this is part 2 of our textual criticism discussion. So just as a recap, part 1, we talked about what textual criticism is, right? This process of comparing manuscripts that are copies of copies of copies with the goal of determining what the original autograph was. And we discussed how this is not unique to the Greek New Testament, that all ancient documents go through this process. And then we spent a lot of time in our previous session looking at the different types of sources, looking at the papyri, you know, that are very old, a lot of them fragmented, but not all of them, you know, 2nd, 3rd century copies of the Greek New Testament. We looked at the majuscules and the minuscules, which are codices, you know, the forerunners to a book, that, you know, come from that 4th, 5th, 6th, 7th century. We discussed translations and lectionaries, and we talked about quotations in the Fathers, and all of these were these part of this manuscript history, this embarrassment of riches. Over 7,000 Greek manuscripts alone are there to be compared. And when we looked at other ancient writings, the closest one we would have would be Homer's Iliad, which has over 2,000. And even then, its oldest one, if you will, is still 6 centuries after the time when Homer would have written the Iliad. When we get into the other documents, we're talking a handful of manuscripts that are older, greater span, if you will, between the original and the copy. The Greek New Testament is clearly the champion of ancient documents in its transmission history and its number. So we spent a lot of time looking at that, the manuscripts. What I want to do in this session is answer the question, what do we do with that? So we have all of these manuscripts. How do we actually go about determining the text? If the process of textual criticism is one of comparing manuscripts, specifically looking at variants to try to determine the original, what do we do? How does this comparison work? So let's talk a little bit about terminology here. So a variant. A variant is any place among the manuscripts in which there is some difference or variation. So a variant isn't a negative term. Like sometimes when you are talking about textual criticism, there might be this idea that there is the original and then there's a variant. And a variant is sort of a bad thing. A variant is just a description. It's a neutral term. And anything that is different, any change is a variant. So if you only have one manuscript, you don't have variants. When you have two manuscripts and you compare it, if there's a difference, that difference is a variant. And that can be wording, word order, omission of word, addition of words, spelling differences. Anything that is a difference is a variant. And I bring that up because when you define variant that way, any difference, then you can start having a large number of variants compile very quickly. And this number can all of a sudden feel daunting. So if we look at the Greek New Testament manuscript tradition, you know, we're talking thousands of manuscripts. There are roughly 300,000 to 400,000 variants. Now keep in mind, the New Testament has about 140,000 words. So think about that. 300,000 to 400,000 variants. That number is a number that can seem disheartening, fantastic. There'll be some scholars who will say, how can you have any hope to determine what the original autographs were when there are 300,000 to 400,000 changes, difference, variants between the manuscripts, when there's no uniform manuscript tradition? How can one hope at all to determine original wording? let alone any confidence in their findings. And they'll say 300 to 400,000 variants. Well, that is a big number on its surface. But maybe it's not really a cause for concern. So recall that there were over 20,000 manuscripts, over 7,000 in Greek alone, 2.6 million pages of text. I mean, logic would just say there are a high number of variants because there are a high number of witnesses. I mean, that alone, you know, leads to it. And if you start to think about the high number of witnesses, the number of variants actually starts looking a little bit low, especially when you think any change is a variant. A variant doesn't have to be an entire passage. A variant can be something as simple as a iota or a nu, which we'll talk a little bit about. And also, I think it's simply incorrect to require that an inspired text produces copies that are exactly alike. You know, the manuscript history, we talked about this in our last session, shows a high degree of reverence and faithfulness to Scripture, both in the number of manuscripts and the insignificant number of meaningful variants. It's simply incorrect. I simply think it is a false presupposition to assume that an inspired text must produce exact copies. So the designation variant signals no degree of importance. It's only a note of difference. So let's continue thinking about these variances. So the question of importance regarding variants is always a question of two factors: viability and meaningfulness. A variant in and of itself might not be a viable one, might not be a meaningful one. So what do we mean by viability? Is the variant attested in the manuscript evidence enough to give plausibility? A variant that only appears in a limited or late manuscript is hardly viable. So for example, would some late scribe be the only one in the entire transmission history to have an authentic word? If I have dozens of manuscripts that say X, 3rd century manuscripts, 4th century manuscripts, 5th century manuscripts, just a good history of X, saying X, and then I have a scribe, 11th century, writes Y instead of X. That's a variant. In our number of 300 to 400,000 variants, that's a variant. That one scribe in the medieval time period that writes Y instead of X, that is a variant, but it's probably not a viable one. In other words, it's probably unlikely that that scribe, of which there's no history of Y, has retained the authentic word. That's what we mean by viability. Meaningful. Does the variant in question impact the meaning of a text? And we're going to talk about meaningfulness in a second. But, you know, just because there's a change might not mean there's a meaningful change. So when we are looking at variants, when we're really doing textual criticism, what we're asking is there a viable history between the two or three or four options of a particular text? And does it matter which way we go? The question must be both meaningful and viable. So what are some meaningless variants? Again, to give you a sense of what we're talking about, because you know, you hear there are 300 to 400,000 variants. Oh, okay. Tell me more. Should I care about that number? Well, most of the variants are spelling differences or nonsense errors. The most common textual variant is what's called the movable nu. So in Greek, for pronunciation purposes, a nu would often be put at the end of a word depending on how that word ended and how the next word began. We do something similar in English with the a and an distinction. You know, if we say a or an, there really is no difference. I mean, that's an indefinite article for us. You know, there's no meaningful difference between a or an. We just choose to put a movable in, if you will, onto it for pronunciation purposes. Greek does the same with new. Most of the variants, or the most, no, I shouldn't say most of the variants, the most common textual variant is the movable new. It's a variant, because there's a difference between a new and no new, but it's not a meaningful one. You know, there are a good example, I think, here that you can talk about how spelling can affect 1 Thessalonians 2:7. Some manuscripts say we were gentle among you. Again, these are English translations of Greek text. Others say we were little children among you. Now, those two differences, which, by the way, is the difference of one letter in Greek. One letter in Greek changes the word from gentle to little children. That's a meaningful. Okay, that would qualify as meaningful. But we also have another manuscript that says we were horses among you. Now, the difference between gentle, little children, and horses is one letter. So when I look at the 1 Thessalonians 2:7, if I was looking at the variants, and let's say we have three variants there, right? We have gentle, little children, horses. I'm going to only think two of those are meaningful. I'm pretty sure the one manuscript that just had the typo, that is horses, is not a meaningful variant, though it's one of the 300 to 400,000 total. So hopefully you're starting to get a picture here. So after spelling, the next most common variant are those that involve synonyms, synonyms that do not impact translation. So one of the things, again, this is where the Greek sort of helps out and us understand a little bit here. So with proper nouns, Greek would often put a definite article in front of it. Now, in English, the definite article, you know, is the word the. The way Greek would use the definite article isn't a one-to-one correspondence to how English uses it. So we would say in English, Jesus saves. We would not say the Jesus saves, right? But in Greek, a proper name often has their definite article in front of it. And so this is actually one of the most common variants, is where you will have a proper name that will have the definite article in front of it, and a proper name that won't have the definite article in front of it in these manuscript history. So you'll have some say Mary, and others say the Mary, Joseph, the Joseph. Now, we would say those mean the same thing, right? But it's a variant, because one has the article, one doesn't have the article. Another very common but meaningless variant are transposing of words. Again, that doesn't change the meaning. Again, we want to think through this a little bit in Greek. So English is a word order driven language. I know the subject of a sentence because the subject of the sentence comes before the verb. I know the direct object of the sentence because the direct object of the sentence comes after the verb. I know an adjective. I know that the green house, because the adjective comes before the noun it modifies. English is not a heavily inflected language. In other words, the endings of the words in English don't have a heavy presence in determining meaning compared to word order. Greek doesn't work the same. Greek is a heavily inflected language. Greek changes its word to show its function. So in Greek, there will be different endings in a word that are called case endings. And those case endings tell you what the word is doing, not where the word is located. The word can come before the verb, the noun can come after the verb, and still be the subject of the sentence. You know that not because of where it's located in the sentence, but its ending. The direct object is noted by its ending. There are different endings. How it shows possession, a different ending. The object of the prepositions will be determined by its ending. Like, so in other words, Greek changes the spelling of a word to show how it's functioning, to show what it's doing. So what does that mean in terms of transcription history? Why did I just give you this little brief introduction to Greek changes? Because you can move words around in a Greek sentence and not change its meaning. I read someplace like you could have something like a three-word sentence in Greek could be done in dozens of different ways and still translated the same in English. So you could have a scribe could move words. If there was a manuscript, one manuscript has subject, verb, direct object. Another manuscript might have direct object, verb, subject. Or another manuscript might even have subject, direct object, verb. Or verb, direct object, subject. And we're not even talking about if they're putting the article there or not. Right? That's even all, we just talked about. You could have those changes. It doesn't change the meaning at all. But it's a variant. Right? That's a very sort of common. Adjective, same way. So in English, the adjective comes before the noun. It doesn't necessarily come before the noun in Greek. Titles, Jesus Christos, Christos Jesus, Jesus Christ, Christ Jesus. That we'll see those kinds of switches happen a lot in the manuscript history. And again, we would say that these transposing of words is a variant, but doesn't change meaning. In fact, once you start thinking about this, spelling differences, is the iota subscripted? In other words, does the iota come below a noun or did it not? Did the new get put in place or did it not? Were there just typos or were there not? Or were the word orders switched around or was it not? When you start looking at all of these possibilities as variants, it actually becomes quite amazing that we actually don't have more of these than we do. The fact that we only have 300 to 400,000, given that we have thousands and millions of pages of manuscripts, for the words of the Greek New Testament, actually shows how much care was given to the transmission of the text. So when we look at this question, meaningfulness and viability, is a variant meaningful? Does it change the meaning of the text? Is it viable? In other words, does it have at least some good sources, which we'll talk about in a second? If we look at that criteria, of this 300 to 400,000 variants, the number that scholars have to throw out there is why you can't trust that you have the autograph. It gets less than 1%. Actually meet this criteria of meaningful and viability. Less than 1%. That's still a good number, but it's not nearly 300 to 400,000. So, and when we talk about meaningful, meaningful is broadly defined as any change in meaning of a text to some degree. So what qualifies as meaningful doesn't necessarily mean that it is the linchpin on which doctrinal decisions are made. That we don't want to elevate meaningful. Let me give you an example. Revelation 13:18. Most manuscripts give the beast number as 666. Right? Most manuscripts have 666. But two decent manuscripts, meaning they're viable, have 616. Now, is there a meaningful distinction doctrinally between 666 and 616? Well, they're both are the numbers of the beast. Right? They're both referring to the same entity. There's not sort of a huge theological understanding of the beast that centers on 666 versus 616. Now, granted, if it was 616, you would have a whole library of dispensational writings that would have to go through a radical change, for that. But again, that's meaningful. One is different than six, but is it just a degree of meaning? Or look at Romans 5:1. Some manuscripts would say we have faith. Other manuscripts say we may have faith. By the way, the difference there in spelling between we have faith or we may have faith or could have faith or should have faith is an indicative versus subjunctive. Like these are the moods, statement, a fact versus a statement of probability. One letter. It's the Omicron versus the Omega, the micro O versus the mega O. And what's even more fascinating is we're not even sure pronunciation-wise if there's a difference. You know, and so if you are doing it, if you're in a scriptoria and you're reading that passage and scribes are writing what you're reading, it's easy enough to understand how one could go with the Omicron, we have faith, and the other with the Omega, we may have faith or we could have faith. But if you think about it, is there a difference in meaning? Yes, but it's a degree of difference. Right? It's a degree of difference between the two. So, and I mean, this is not to say, and I don't want to mislead here. What is it Samuel Clemens says? There are facts, right? And then, there are lies, there are facts, and then there are statistics, right? You know, something along those lines, the quote I get wrong, but the idea that statistics can be used as lies, right? And I want to be honest here. I'm not saying that within this 1%, there aren't interpretive matters that turn on text-critical decisions. There are, right? And we're going to point some of the big ones out. But only to make sure that those who attempt to make hay out of the statistics are exaggerating the matter. The vast majority of these meaningful variants are single words or phrases, some verses, and then there's a few big passages, which we'll talk about, Mark 16 and John 7. All right, so this is what we're dealing with, right? So as we walk through this process, we're looking at manuscripts, all these manuscripts. These manuscripts history, we have them laid out before us, if you will. And then we're looking at the variants, places where there are differences, places where one manuscript says alpha, the next manuscript says beta, or what have you. And then as we look at those variants, we ask questions, are they meaningful and viable? Like, do I even care to go any farther? I mean, part of it is like, how much effort do I want to spend on this? If I find a variant that is not viable or not meaningful, do I really want to spend a lot of time going through a process of comparing it? Probably not. But what about when it meets that criteria? It's meaningful and viable. Then what do you do? All right, this is what I want to spend a little bit now talking about, is this method of making decisions. Because ultimately, you have to make a decision on what the preferred text is. Ultimately, you have to come to the decision, doing text criticism, of what you think Matthew wrote, what you think Paul wrote, or John, or the author of Hebrews. So once they're both meaningful and viable, how do you proceed? Well, the first assumption, this is an important assumption. The original is available somewhere among the variants. Now, this isn't the same as saying the original is available in this particular manuscript. But somewhere among the variants, the original is available. Without that assumption, how do you even proceed? Right? So you proceed with the assumption that there is an ability to recover the original. And then the key is to examine what we call both external and internal evidences. External evidence refers to the manuscripts themselves, the character of the manuscript, and we'll talk both about these. Internal evidence refers to the nature of a specific witness, so what a scribe might do, or how a particular document works, or an author works, or something along those lines. And this evaluation is both science and art. It is interpretive. There is a process we follow, but there's also a artistic consideration to that. There's also a method that requires more than just adding numbers in a column and coming up with an answer. The approach is more explain the errors than it is find the original. And that may seem a little bit counterintuitive, but as you go through this process, the idea is not find the original. The idea is more which variant explains how the other variants came about. Which one most likely gave birth, if you will, to changes? You know, because in that process, if you can sort of explain how a variant might have come about, how a change might have occurred, what you're left with was the one that was most likely the original. And I think what I like about that process is that also requires you to consider all the variants that are meaningful and viable. Instead of just, it's a control. Instead of just saying, well, I want it to be this one, because this is what I grew up learning in Sunday school class, so I want it to be this one. Well, it controls against that. Because remember that quote I did in our first session from the Dean of Canterbury, that we must be willing to sacrifice the most choicest of texts. And this process of saying, I'm going to go through a method that helps me understand which one most likely gave birth to the errors will help me from just grabbing hold of the error because I like it better or I want it more. So it's a measure of control in this process as well. But let's move on. Let's see how this works. So let's talk about external evidence. What's the process we follow when we're dealing with external evidence? And remember, external evidence is the manuscripts themselves. And in a lot of ways, when we think about external evidence and internal evidence, external evidence takes priority over internal evidence. It isn't the only thing we use. It's not the sole basis for decision making. In other words, we don't just care about external evidence only, but it definitely is the first among equals, if you will. Now, not all evidence bears the same weight. It isn't a numbers game. Bruce Metzger, a brilliant text critical scholar, writes, witnesses are to be weighed rather than counted. Here's what we mean by that. So if I have a reading, right, if I have a reading that has numerous later manuscripts supporting it. So say I have, say I have 500 manuscripts that all say the same reading, that all support the reading X. But all of them are much later in time. 10th century, 11th century, 12th century. And then I have a smaller number, a couple dozen, that support Y. But they're 2nd century, 3rd century. They're in Greek manuscripts, not in Latin manuscripts. Like the hundreds might seem to be, well, don't you go with that? Because there's more of them. But they weigh less. Right? Their combined weight doesn't necessarily reach the weight of the older manuscripts. So it's not just a numbers game is what we're getting at. It's like not all manuscripts have equal value. Older witnesses, especially from reliable text types, are preferred. You know, that text type, we talked about in our last session. That was that Alexandrian, Western, and Byzantine. And what we saw with the Alexandrian text family, right? When we looked at patterns of different manuscripts and they started to emerge, what we saw and what got labeled the Alexandrian family, tend to be mostly around Egypt, North Africa, was over the centuries still a strong proclivity to staying the same and not a lot of change occurring in that line. So when we'd have that family line and older dating, 2nd century papyri, 4th century Sinaiticus or Vaticanus, you know, we give a lot of weight to that. Closer in time, less scribal family tendency towards change. We like those. We also like manuscripts where a reading shows consistency across a wider geographical distribution. So if I find manuscripts, you know, that support, so if I'm looking at variants, if I'm looking at readings, and one reading has manuscripts from, Italy and Mediterranean, and as well as ones from North Africa, or even as far as into the, you know, Latin West, if you will, I start getting the same variant, the same reading supported in manuscripts that have a wide geographical distribution, as opposed to a reading that might just seem to only occur in a very specific area. Well, I like the ones with the wider geographical distribution, because it just seems to indicate that they had a more common source that sort of gave instead of something that got localized for a particular reason. Again, all this stuff works together. So the strongest readings, right, in terms of external evidence, will be the ones supported by the oldest manuscripts representing reliable text types and the widest geographical spread. We like those. We like the ones that occur very early within the Alexandrian family, spread out geographically. And again, I want to show you an example of how this works, but that's a little bit of external evidence. What about internal evidence? When do we use internal evidence? What is internal evidence? Like, external evidence was the qualities of the manuscripts themselves. Well, what's internal evidence? Well, here's where we're looking at wording. The actual wording, language style, context. Internal evidence, it looks within the manuscript itself. It asks what a scribe might do or what an author might do. And when do we use it? Well, its primary value lies when external evidence is not decisive. So if I'm looking at an issue, a variance, a couple of different readings, and I look at the external evidence, and reading X, it's got some good manuscripts supporting. It's got good old manuscripts, good geographic distribution, Alexandrian, we like it, good Western, not just Byzantine. Then I look at another variant, Y, same thing. It's got some good old ones. It's got some papyri. It's got Alexandrian. It has good geographical distribution. So I'm looking at X and I'm looking at Y and I'm looking at the external evidence and I might be like, kind of close. This is when I need to use internal evidence as the next methodological layer. When external evidence isn't decisive, internal evidence is important. So the governing principle is this, that the reading that best explains the origin of the others is most likely the original, right? The one that gives birth to the others in terms of internal evidence is most likely the original. So what are the things we look at when we're talking about internal evidence? Well, I'll put them in two broad categories, if you will. One we call transcriptional probabilities and the other intrinsic probabilities. And I'm going to talk a little bit about each of these categories. But transcriptional relates to sort of established scribal tendencies, what scribes tend to do. Intrinsic is what an author is more likely to have done. Right, so when we talk about transcriptional probabilities, it's what the copyist might have done, like how a copyist or a scribe behaves that might have led to a change. Whereas intrinsic looks like what is that writer, that specific writer most likely to do, or the author. So transcriptional probabilities, scribal tendencies. Well, scribes make errors. We all make errors. There's a scribe can overlook or skip a portion of text. You're copying a text, and all of a sudden you just jump two words. You didn't mean to. You just did in your copying, right? That's not uncommon. You can carelessly omit a word. Maybe it's not uncommon for a scribe to write something once instead of twice. Like there could have been something in the original that had a portion written twice. You just did it once, or vice versa. You wrote something twice instead of once. Maybe you have metathesis where you reverse letters or words, or you combine or divide words. Words that were, especially if you're dealing with no spacing issues. Right, and then all of a sudden, words that were meant to be a compound word together become two separate ones, or two separate ones become compound. There are always these challenging for scribal errors, and that's a common. It's not an intentional. It's just part of the life of transmitting texts. Also, another transcriptional probability we talk about is we prefer the difficult reading. A reading that appears initially to be difficult but makes sense is more likely original, as a scribe might seek to aid the reader by smoothing out the text. So here's what we mean by this. So if I have two readings, and not a nonsensical one, not like we were horses, like I looked at in the First Thessalonians text, not that kind of thing. But I have two readings, and one is a little bit more challenging. Either it presents a theological challenge, or maybe it presents something that would be less harmonious, right, in terms of the Gospels. And there's a change to it. Most likely the scribe, it's more likely for a scribe to take a difficult reading and make it less so than to do the opposite. To take something that causes no difficulty at all and make a change to make it difficult. You know, and again, this isn't done because it's some malevolence on a scribal part trying to exert ecclesiastical authority. It's likely done out of love and consideration and knowledge of the text. You know, so we know why the scribe might do that. And so when we have a choice between two readings and one's more difficult, we like the more difficult one. We think that's more likely to have been authentic. Shorter can be stronger than longer. Scribes are more likely to add than to take out. A scribe is more likely to add a clarifying comment or put in, maybe there's a creedal phrase that's very common that gets sort of added in, or an expansion. It's more likely for a scribe to do that than to take out. Again, and all of these aren't universal rules. We're talking this whole thing gets sort of taken together artistically. Less harmonized readings are preferred. Scribes might want to match a quotation. So if a New Testament writer is quoting an Old Testament passage, but the quotation that they're using is different than sort of the known quotation that the scribe understands. They know Paul is citing Isaiah, or they know Jesus is referencing Daniel, but it isn't necessarily the wording that scribe knows. A scribe might change it to harmonize it, to make it align with the known quotation that's being referenced. You know, a scribe is more likely to do that than to do the opposite, to take a known sort of established quotation and change it to be less so. Again, it just makes sense. Less grammatically refined are preferred. Scribes tend to fix grammar. You know, so if there's a text that has some grammatical clumsiness, a scribe is more likely to fix it than to go the other way. Right? And so again, these are the things that we look at, and rarely are there doctrinally motivated alterations. Most often, these other occurrences account for change, scribal errors, difficult, readings, etc. It's rare that actually a major doctrinal thing is governing the alterations. I'm not saying it doesn't happen. Don't misunderstand me. I'm just saying in terms of numbers, that's not the most common reason for a scribal change. What about intrinsic probabilities? Again, this is looking at how an author operates. So when I'm looking at two variants, the first thing I'm looking at, is the external evidence. And after that, then I'm looking to see which ones make sense within scribal tendencies. But then I'm also, which variant kind of makes sense within what an author would do. The variant that has the most continuity with an author's style is likely the original. In other words, the variant that coheres with how that writer is working in that book, their theology or their themes or their word choice. Writers tend to be consistent in their writing. They don't tend to all of a sudden make in a very specific document itself a radical change. Now, writers can write differently. A letter that I'm writing to my wife will sound differently than a letter I write to the admissions office, of my son who's looking to college. I'm going to have a stylistic difference. No one should look at the letter I write to my wife and the letter I write to a college and say, well, these are clearly different styles, so it must be a different author. I mean, that would be nonsensical. The occasion determines the style. But the letter I'm writing to my wife shouldn't have a radical change in style within that letter. So that's what we're talking about. When we're talking about intrinsic probabilities, we're looking at how is a writer operating, working in a particular writing. And then the variant that best aligns with how that writer is working is most likely original, the best one that coheres. So for example, take John 14:17. One manuscript variant that we have there is the Holy Spirit will be in you. Another variant has the Holy Spirit is in you. Right? The difference there being will be versus is. Well, in terms of coherence to John, the future seems to fit the context of the gospel better. What about John 4:1, where one variant has Jesus referred to as Lord? Another manuscript variant has Jesus referred to as Jesus. And in fact, many of the stronger manuscripts, like on the external evidence, have Lord. Right? It's still, Jesus is still viable. Good, strong manuscripts have Jesus, but a lot of the ones we really like have Lord. But John rarely refers to Jesus as Lord prior to the resurrection. So from an intrinsic probability, Jesus, which he uses quite often, has a greater argument to being the original because of how John operates within the gospel. Again, all this is taken, together. This is that artistic aspect. It's not a mathematical equation where you simply, put all the variables in and it kicks out a receipt. You have to ask these challenges. So the textual variant that has the greatest claim to authenticity will be found in the earliest, best, and most geographically widespread witnesses. Will fit the context and the author's style and will be the likely originator of its rival readings on a literary level. What I would like us to do is I want to look at one passage. I want to look at one passage, and then we'll look at some of the broader ones. But I want you to get a sense of how this happens. But we're going to pick that up at our next session. Thank you for working with us on text criticism. I look forward to continuing as we now take what we've learned on external evidences and internal evidence and now apply it to some actual biblical texts.
This is Dr. Mark Jennings in his teaching on New Testament text criticism. This is session number 2, How We Do Textual Criticism, Methodology.